From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, The Daily Show's youth correspondent and trend spotter, Dimitri Martin. He's also a stand-up comic. Earlier this year, he had a special on Comedy Central. It's just come out on DVD. Also, we meet actor Anthony Anderson. After playing a ruthless gangbanger and heroin dealer on the FX series The Shield, he's now playing a cop in the new Fox series K-ville. It's set in New Orleans after Katrina. Anderson also played the recording engineer in Hustle and Flow. He was shot in the face in The Departed. He started his career in film comedies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dimitri Martin, is a stand-up comic and a contributor to The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Young people, they're more than the future. They are our target demographic. But when we want to learn more about them, we turn to our own Dimitri Martin and Trend Spotting.
Trends. Martin started contributing to The Daily Show in 2005. In 2004, Entertainment Weekly named him one of the 25 funniest people in America. Earlier this year, he had a special on Comedy Central called Dimitri Martin Person. It just came out on DVD. We'll hear an excerpt a little later. Right now, let's hear him in action on The Daily Show. In his role as trend spotter, he did a report on life coaches, counselors who help you solve problems and help you get where you want to go in life. When Martin's report was over, he sat down with Jon Stewart.
Obviously, it's a fascinating trend, Dimitri. Is there a way for someone at home to know if they themselves need a coach?
Well, recently, I came up with one. Before that, there wasn't. Mm-hmm. But I took the time to create the Life of Satisfaction Expectation Ratio, mm-hmm. which is hard to say, but the acronym is easy. It's LOSER, LOSER. Currently, it's the only tool available to calculate one's need for a life coach. And it's easy. You can do it at home. You just take the age you were when you moved out of your parents' house, multiply by the age you lost your virginity, plus the square root of your monthly income divided by the number of cats you have, plus one.
And what number would you get that would indicate that you needed a coach or...
If you were a loser?
Yes.
Well, there's no answer per se, but if you bothered copying down the equation, you need one.
Dimitri Martin, welcome to Fresh Air. You have a new DVD of a one-man comedy show that you did on Comedy Central, and it's called Dimitri Martin Person.
Yeah.
And in your stand-up comedy, you do a lot of, like, observational one-liners. You know, one or two lines about something that you find, like, a little ridiculous or absurd. Then you move on to another observation. And these are about absurdities in life or in language. Why do you gravitate to that kind of humor as opposed to, like, the long story?
Well, when I was younger, a lot of my friends who were comedians, it seems that when they were young, when they were kids, they were comedy nerds. They had a lot of comedy albums and they knew a lot about comedy, say 2,000-year-old man or something like that. I don't know how much I was a comedy nerd. I think I was just a standard nerd. I think I was just a kind of straight up nerd. For me, my interests were more like brain teasers, which, you know, I don't know if this is the coolest thing to admit, but I liked, you know, those puzzle books and that kind of stuff and just taking a pen and, you know, trying to figure out some weird Mensa thing or something like that. So I was aware of comedy. I like comedy. I like joking around, all that kind of stuff as a kid. But I never thought of that as an endpoint or a place to spend my time. That seemed like just a side thing or a way to relate to people. My focus, aside from, say, breakdancing, was puzzles, trying to solve puzzles.
That's what all the hip-hop guys say, that in addition to breakdancing,
it's very similar.
They liked puzzles.
Yeah, my comedy is very similar to gangster rap. there's a lack of helping verbs. some awareness of jewelry, whether in public or private, and toughness. I mean, you got to be tough to be a comedian.
Let's hear an excerpt of your new DVD. And this is a DVD of your stand-up show that was on Comedy Central. So as we're about to hear, Dimitri Martin often performs comedy backing it up with a guitar or a piano or a guitar and harmonica. You know, it's as if he was singing, but what he's really doing is stand-up. So let's hear part of that, like, instrumental with comedy part of his show.
Uh-oh. There's a store in my neighborhood called Futon World. I love that name, Futon World. It makes me think of a magical place that becomes less comfortable over time. Whenever I use my computer, I don't type LOL. I type LQTM. Laugh quietly to myself. It's more honest. By the way, if you want to sound like a creep,
Just add the word ladies to the end of things that you say. You sound like a creep. It could be harmless, too. Like, thanks for coming to my show. Ladies. Help, I've fallen into a well and I'm trapped. Ladies. It's like a jacuzzi with really high walls. You know you want it. Went to this clothing store. The lady working there, she got mad at me. She said, what size are you? I said, actual. This ain't a trick, baby. She was amazing. I never met a woman like her before. She showed me to the dressing room. She said, if you need anything, I'm Jill. I was like, oh my God. I never met a woman before with a conditional identity. What if I don't need anything? Who are you? If you don't need anything, I'm Mike.
That's Dimitri Martin from his new DVD of his Comedy Central show. And Dimitri Martin is also a correspondent for The Daily Show. I really like that ladies bit. How did you realize that that anything you say is going to sound particularly smarmy if you end it with ladies?
Yeah, I don't know. I just know the tone of that word. It's just funny, just ladies. It just seems, that just popped to me. And it's funny because a lot of my jokes, I don't think I often come from hearing something and then it becomes a joke. It's usually just looking at an object and then it's just some turning it around in my head and I'm like, oh, there's the joke. But that one, it just, yeah, it just lent itself to that nice structure too of you could do endless examples and just by saying ladies, it just kind of gives you, it's a shortcut.
There's one on your CD where you wonder, what if you said sort of after every sentence? How that, after some things, that's okay, but after other things, it's really horrible. Can you give us some examples of that and tell us how you thought of it?
Yeah, that one, the original version of that joke was sort of is just a harmless thing to say. It's just a filler. And that must have been from a substitute teacher, somebody who'd always just say, it's sort of, you know, this, that, sort of, you know, if we could sort of. And I just thought, you don't need sort of, man. That doesn't, that's not doing anything in there. But then I thought, wait, if it's at the end, you know, then it can mean everything. Like, you know, I love you, sort of. Yeah, that's different. Or you're going to live. Or it's a boy. That's where sort of, yeah, that's going to be more of an impact. And I just, and I also have that other joke about if you start a sentence with the word dude, I wondered what the most intelligent thing ever said was that started with the word dude. You know? And I think that joke was something like, you know, dude, these are isotopes. Or dude, you're going to live. Good news, we removed your kidney. You're going to be fine. I think the ending of that one was, dude, I am so stoked to accept this Nobel Prize. I want to thank all my homies.
So you really do work these out as puzzles. You kind of think of, like, what would make this ridiculous?
I think so, yeah. Sometimes there's more intention and I'm working on it. I remember I tried to write a joke about revolving doors for like 2 years or something. Sometimes I see something and I go, I know that's funny. To me, there's something funny about revolving doors. I don't know what the words are for it, but it feels funny to me. And then I'll work on it and then eventually it might emerge as a joke. I have a list of things that just I am convinced are funny, but I haven't figured out how. And then, of course, other things, it's just an improv or it just floats into your head and it's funny immediately.
Do you have lists of things in your pockets now?
Yeah, I have like sometimes on a receipt there'll be a joke or I woke up, the other day I was cleaning my apartment and I find little slips of paper that just have jokes on them that I wrote in the moment I was somewhere and I thought, oh, that's funny. And then I find them later and it's just like this weird, unfunny fairy is leaving me messages around the apartment or something. I found something in my room the other day I was cleaning and it said, a stalker is like a private investigator who no one has hired or something like that. It was like between my bed and like this bureau and I was cleaning and I found this piece of paper and it was like a weird message to myself. It was like an unwise, wise man leaving me notes. A failed fortune cookie writer is leaving things around my apartment.
So what did you do?
But it is funny. It's
entertaining. Did you put it in the trash or put it in your act?
No, it's in, I have these folders. I have these weird manila folders that are, they're just, you know, if I'm really blocked, I can just go dig through it and say, oh, you know what? That's not funny, but I think I know what I was trying to do. That could be funny. And mm-hmm. then I go try it, you know, put it on my list and try it that night. And then it's not funny. I say, okay, yeah, it's not funny.
Now, you'd been a law student before becoming a comic. Yale Law School, was it?
No, I went to Yale for college, and then I went to NYU Law School for law school.
And it was toward the end of law school that you realized, oh, I don't want to do this. I think I'll try comedy.
I dropped out. I did 2 years out of the three, and then I left because it's a better story.
Why did it take you that long to realize? And did you feel so invested already, both financially and just in terms of, like, your whole mental state and your time? Was it really hard after making that investment to say, mistake, I'm leaving?
The interesting thing was I had a full scholarship. I turned down a couple other schools because I got money at NYU. And at the time, my girlfriend at that time was going to medical school in New York. So then the chance was we could be together and I wouldn't have to pay for law school. So I went for it. When I got there, like a month in, I realized, uh-oh, this is boring. I don't like this. I'm talking about 1 month in the first year, I kind of had that revelation. But I think I was so entrenched in my life plan, in my idea, hey, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm talking from like seventh grade. Just after breakdancing, I decided I was going to be a lawyer. Like, it was in that spot in my timeline. Literally, I'm telling you, I realized, oh, you know what? It was like a to-do list. Oh, yeah, career, corporate lawyer, sounds great. Done. Never worried about it again. Went straight, you know, high school, college, LSATs, got in there, got the scholarship. And then when I finally realized I don't like what I'm doing each day, I had no other plan or, I guess, like, version of myself that wasn't a lawyer. So it took me that long. I was a White House intern after that first year because I thought, oh, maybe politics or government or something. But that wasn't for me either.
So when you realized that a legal career was going to be boring for you, that after all this planning, it wasn't right for you after all, what made you think you could be a comic?
Well, I remember doing some very specific soul searching and thinking, okay, I'm dreading each day when I go to school. Not because it's too hard or it's just no passion. I'm just not excited about what I'm doing. I just feel like, I think I'm too young to be feeling this way already. Something's wrong. So I just did like little thought experiments and I thought, okay, forget about money, status, or what anybody thinks about me. When I wake up in the morning, what activities would I look forward to doing? Do you know what I mean? Just what physically could I spend my time on that I get excited about? Second part of that, how do I get money for that? If I could figure out those two things, then I'm set, because then I'll just do the activities that I like, and then I have money so I could have a house and food and stuff, you know? And then I thought, well, what do I like doing? I like joking around with my friends. Okay, I guess comedian. And then that was the beginning of that, and I just thought, okay, I guess I can't be in law school anymore, because then I can't do both. So I dropped out. Also, NYU Law School is adjacent to one comedy club and across the street, basically, from another.
Did you
so
play there?
I was walking by comedy clubs every day.
Did you play those clubs?
My first set I ever did was across the street from the law school. The summer, I dropped out in the spring, and then that summer I got on stage for the first time.
What'd you do?
I did 12 jokes.
Tell us one or two of them.
Okay, I think I can remember some of these. This is 10 years ago. I started on Bastille Day of 97. Okay, 12 jokes my first night. My goal was to get a laugh, one real laugh on one of my jokes. That would be the sign, yes, you can be a comedian. By the way, I booked two nights in a row. Monday was my first night, and Tuesday was going to be in another room. Monday, I go up. 12 jokes. I had jokes like, one of them was, they were pretty complicated. I think one of them was this. I made a deodorant that smells like my friend Jim. It's called Jim. Sometimes I wear it and I hang out with his blind friend Jerry. Then Jerry thinks he's with Jim. Sometimes I wear my Jerry deodorant, then Jerry thinks he's alone. That's my first night.
Did that get a laugh?
I think that one got a laugh. Then I had a joke about, because this is a while ago, I had a joke about I don't prank call people anymore. That's too old school. What I do now is I prank people on their beepers. But then it's difficult because then they call me and I have to answer the phone in a threatening way. And it was this whole thing. It was really complicated. But I got laughs on six of the jokes. I got laughs on half the jokes.
Uh-huh.
I wish I could remember more of them. I lost the tape. I taped it, but I don't know where those jokes are anymore. I think the first night I might have done the joke about I was riding an escalator and I tripped. I fell down the stairs for an hour and a half. That joke held. I did that in the first special. That was one of those that kind of lived on, you know? A couple were good enough. Most of them weren't. There was a joke about being bad at lying, but it wasn't that I was bad at telling the lies. I was bad at picking the topics that I lied about. So somebody would say, you know, what time is it? 4:30. Okay. I mean, you know, I don't know why I have this cool interview with you here and I'm just doing the worst jokes I ever wrote. You guys could really make me look way less funny than it might be.
My guest is Dimitri Martin. His Comedy Central special has just come out on DVD. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dimitri Martin. He's a contributor to The Daily Show. He's the trend spotter and youth correspondent. His Comedy Central special has just come out on DVD. Let's talk about your past a little bit. Your father was a Greek Orthodox priest.
Yeah.
So you went to church a lot?
I went to church a lot every Sunday, and I was an altar boy from very young until I went to college. I was actually head altar boy, and that might have been because my dad was the priest, but I think I had pretty good skills as well and probably earned it. But I was the top altar boy, I'd say, probably in my county.
What were your father's sermons like?
My father was funny. He was really funny. He loved Bill Cosby. He loved Saturday Night Live, Peter Sellers. Pink Panther was a big part of my childhood. We used to watch the Pink Panther movies. His sermons, in retrospect, I realize, they were like 20-minute sets. It was like him doing 20 minutes for an audience. Anecdotal, very personal, and just really funny. And it was never doctrinal. And he spoke extemporaneously. There were no notes. He didn't read his sermon or have this big prepared thing. He'd have a couple ideas jotted down on an envelope or something I'd see up there on the pulpit. And then he would just go. He would just kind of talk. And he would just find these jokes, you know?
Do you still go to church? Do you still practice?
I haven't been to church in a while. I'm not such a good Greek Orthodox churchgoer anymore. Maybe because a lot of times I'm traveling. I don't know. I guess I just kind of drifted. I don't know how much I've questioned my faith or any of that kind of stuff. I feel like I got busy. And fart jokes take a lot of time, you know, and working around the clock. But I liked growing up in the church. I think it was a good place. And my dad just had a really good style. He was just something about putting your heart out there. People just, if you can be authentic, I think it just goes a long way with people, whether it's in a church or on a stage or anywhere.
So do you think of yourself as a comic as trying to be authentic in the way that your father was as a priest?
I think it took me a long time to realize that, but yes, definitely. That's what I liked about his comedy as a person.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't very derisive. He wasn't, just not a lot of venom in him. He just, there's a sweetness to the way he approached things. That's just who he was.
So your father was a priest, but your family also had a restaurant, a diner?
Yeah, we started with a Greek food stand called Shorty's Shish Kebab at the Jersey Shore because my grandfather is just about 5 feet, or was just about 5 feet tall. And that was the seasonal business where we sold shish kebab and gyro at the boardwalk. We had that for a bunch of years. And then my parents took all their life savings and they got a diner. And so then we had a Greek diner that we still have with my uncles. And well, my uncle and my grandparents and stuff.
Was this by the shore?
The stand, Shorty's Shish Kebab, was on the boardwalk right next to the beach. And then the Sandcastle is the name of the diner, and that's like 6 miles from the beach.
Oh, so it must have been great as a kid to have, you know, a family-run food stall on the beach. What a great excuse to be on the beach a lot.
In theory, except they made me work there from age 11. I had to work at Shorty's. In a windowless basement. I'm right next to the beach, and I'm in a basement with my grandfather. My job was to skewer shish kebab, 50 cents an hour.
Wow.
They paid me 50 cents an hour. And I had to, you have to take the meat out of this like lemony, your hands get all, you know, corroded or whatever. And then I had to put meat on metal sticks for 50 cents an hour. And I was a bad worker. every hour I ask for my 50 cents at the end of the hour, and I go try to win a watch. You know those things that, like, the thing turns around and you try to get a watch? So I would want immediate, like, gratification. I was like, I want my 50 cents to work for me.
So every hour you'd earn 50 cents the hard way and then lose it.
Yeah, I'd go run and try to win a watch.
So you'd never have any money at the end.
Yeah, I'd never have any money. But that it was fun being at the boardwalk because I loved – that was the skateboarding, surfing, all that kind of stuff. And so I had my surfboard in the basement. I'm skewering shish kebab and my surfboard's right next to me. And I'm just thinking, oh, as soon as I'm done, I can go surf. I'm at the beach. So that was pretty cool. But then working at the diner, it's the same thing. Busboy against my will, waiter, host. But that's where the puzzle books came in. I used to just bring puzzle books to work and just walk around thinking about puzzles and stuff. And eventually that became jokes, I think.
And how many pieces of meat can fit on a skewer?
I think it was 5 with vegetables in between.
So one more thing. Since you're a former law student and almost lawyer, can you actually understand your own contracts?
Pretty much. 2/3 of them, because I only went to law school for 2 years.
Well, Dimitri Martin, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dimitri Martin is a contributor to The Daily Show. His Comedy Central special has just come out on DVD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Anthony Anderson talks about shooting his new show, Kayville, on location in New Orleans. He plays a cop protecting his damaged city, a departure from his role as a gang leader and heroin dealer on the cop series, The Shield. Anderson's films include The Departed and Hustle and Flow. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Anthony Anderson, is the star of the new Fox series, Kayville, which will feature its second episode tonight. Anderson plays a cop in New Orleans 2 years after Hurricane Katrina, protecting those who still live in the city. It's shot on location. His role as Marlon Boulay, a member of the Felony Action Squad, is quite a departure from his role on the cop series, The Shield, as Antoine Mitchell, a brutal gang leader and heroin dealer. Anderson's recent movies include Transformers, Hustle and Flow, and The Departed. He's also been in a lot of comedies like Me, Myself, and Irene, Barbershop, and Malibu's Most Wanted. Let's start with a scene from Kayville. During the hurricane, Boulay's partner got scared and abandoned him. Boulay's new partner, played by Cole Hauser, is new to the force and claims to be new to New Orleans. But Boulay gets a little suspicious of that claim after a chase in which his partner seems to know his way around the city. So Boulay confronts him.
Should have known when you told me to take the neutral ground.
What?
And just yesterday, at the quarter, I drew that map on the ground. You knew this city.
Yeah, so what?
Look up. What do you see, huh?
I see the sky, the sun.
Yeah. See the street signs?
What?
See the punks around here, they steal them to confuse the cops. But look at you. Man from Cincinnati, driving the Ziggies and asking no directions.
I've been there, Boulay. Now what the hell's gotten into you?
You lie again. I swear to God, I'll cuff you before you even see my hands. Who are you, cop? What's your angle?
It's not my problem that your last partner deserted you. Now you're paranoid and you're cracking up.
How do you know these streets then?
I did my basic training in Fort Polk and Leesville, you idiot. And I came down here all the time. Now put your gun down. You ever do that again, and one of us ain't walking away.
Cole Hauser and my guest Anthony Anderson in a scene from the new Fox series, Kayville. Anthony Anderson, a pleasure to have you. Welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe your character in Kayville?
Oh, Marlon Boulay. Very conflicted. He's not a by-the-books kind of officer. You know, he's the kind of officer that you want on your police force protecting your streets. But, you know, I do have my vices. I drink on the job, given the circumstances and everything that, you know, I went through in the last couple of years with Hurricane Katrina coming through and decimating our city. And, you know, even though the story is 2 years later, still dealing with the abandonment of my partner leaving me, still have abandonment issues because my wife and my daughter have left him and relocated to Atlanta now. So, you know, just dealing with that and trying to rebuild our community, rebuild our city, and literally rebuild our home.
What are some of the neighborhoods and locations that you're shooting in New Orleans?
You know, we're all over New Orleans. We're in the lower Ninth Ward, which was completely decimated by the storm. Upper Nine, you know, we're in the French Quarter. You know, we're all over the city of New Orleans. New Orleans isn't just a backdrop for our television show. New Orleans is actually a character an essential, integral part of our show. So we're all over the place. And, you know, we really couldn't cheat this on a back lot, you know, or on a soundstage someplace. It would be doing a disservice to the show, but more importantly, it would be doing a disservice to the people of New Orleans and what their rebuilding efforts are. So we have to be there, and we're all over in every nook and cranny.
Are you finding the city to be as dangerous as depicted on the pilot?
It can be. You know, another thing that I've done and that I do on a continual basis, I roll with SWAT on ride-alongs in the middle of the night. And, you know, you really get to see the city, you know, unveiled. You know, there's nothing like riding along with a SWAT team during a midnight raid, you know, 2 a.m., serving high-risk felony warrants in some of the worst projects in the city with MP3 and MP4. Assault rifles and concussion grenades and full body armor, you know, to witness that firsthand is unbelievable.
Have there been times when you were out with a SWAT team and the people that were about to arrest recognized you from one of your movies or recognized you as the heavy Antoine Mitchell from The Shield?
Oh, yeah. It was 1 a.m. Got a call that, you know, this was a narcotics house. And so SWAT rolls there. They secure the perimeter, the whole block, and they move in. And it actually just happened to be a crack den. So they pull out 11 addicts, handcuff them to one another around the Suburban. And, you know, SWAT has surrounded them. And, you know, they're all tweaking. And one guy looks over, and I know he's really tweaking now because he's looking at me. And he's like, oh, damn, that's Kangaroo Jack. That's Kangaroo Jack. Oh, man, you done made my night. You made my night. And I was like, brother, you're handcuffed to 10 other crackheads surrounded by SWAT with assault rifles about to go down. And you're telling me you want my autograph and I've made your night? He was like, oh, yeah, man, yeah. And I was like, okay. Okay, so that was one of the lighter moments of rolling around with SWAT.
My guest is Anthony Anderson. He stars in the new Fox series, K-ville. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Anthony Anderson. After playing a gang leader and heroin dealer on the cop series The Shield, he's now playing a cop in New Orleans on the new Fox series K-ville. Now, what was it like for you going from being like a really cold, mean character on The Shield? You know, you're not only a heroin dealer, a big heroin dealer, but you're the head of this really violent gang in L.A. Were on The Shield. Now you're in prison. So what was it like for going from being a character like that, who's always at odds with the police, to being a cop on your new series, K-ville?
You know, I loved it. I loved the dichotomy of it, you know, being on one extreme and taking it to the other. Both characters are similar in my opinion. I mean, you know, Antoine Mitchell felt this is the hand that he was dealt, and he played it as best he could. And, you know, in his mind's eye, yeah, he was a heroin dealer and, you know, the head of this gang, this cartel or whatever you want to call it. But he was also doing great things in the community, you know, building community centers and bringing computers into these community centers for inner city youth for them to, you know, better themselves. And he didn't really necessarily follow him in his footsteps, but, you know, this was his way of giving back. This was his atonement for, I believe, for what, you know, he was doing in the neighborhood.
And in your description of Antoine, I don't think you sufficiently gave him credit for how, like, violent and just really cold he is when he feels that somebody is his enemy. And to demonstrate that, I want to play a scene from The Shield. Here is Antoine Mitchell. You had a gang called the One-Niners, and you've been dealing tar heroin. You've made a deal with a cop named Shane and his partner. Mm-hmm. And these cops are getting a take of your money in return for protecting you. But a big stash that you were hiding in a church was busted. And you think that Shane informed on you. And now you intend on letting him know that you're the one who has the power. So Shane speaks first. He's played by Walton Goggins.
Look, they may have grabbed your shit, but the investigation is sealed off. No roads lead back to you. Just say thank you, Antoine.
Do you know how much you cost me today, huh? In product and in manpower.
Well,
do
if you'd
you
have kept me in the loop on your tar castle, then maybe I could have kept an eye out for you, homie.
Yeah. Oh! Grab his piece! Give me both that gun!
Payback, bitch!
I don't get played, and I ain't your homie.
Oh, man, you're gonna get...
Shut up! You knew they were taking down my shit today. My nigga saw you faggots on the goddamn raid. So how you trying to tell me now there was nothing that you could do? Huh? You think you was ever making moves around here?
You're not stupid enough to bring that kind of heat down on your ass.
That's my guest, Anthony Anderson, and Walton Goggins in a scene from The Shield. And I should mention to our listeners that you're not actually meeting out the blows in this. You're not the one beating up the two cops. Your boys are doing that, but you're watching and directing them as they do it. What did you do to play somebody like this? What did you get in touch with in yourself, or what did you remember from people who you might have known in the past?
That's exactly what I did. You know, I'm from Compton, California. Grew up in the inner city. And knew characters like Antoine Mitchell. who basically did what he did. They were running the streets, but yet they saw it in themselves to mentor, if you will, to kids like me. And it was like, you know what, Anthony, you shouldn't be out here doing this, you know. And because I'm telling you that this is what I'm going to help the neighborhood do, you know. And they set up programs in the city parks. They set up community centers. I knew Antoine Mitchell's, you know, so I pulled on that, you know, an actor who I've met, never had the chance to work with, Idris Elba. I liked what he did with his character Stringer Bell on The Wire, and I just looked at how he worked and how he maneuvered as that character, and took bits and pieces from that and just married it with, you know, my own ideas, you know. And the things that you heard, you know, from the excerpt of the Shield that you just played just now, and what it ultimately did, you know, Antoine Mitchell actually, you know, shot someone in, later on in that scene. And
a teenage girl who informed on him, and he's going to pay back.
Yeah, and you know, even though I did, you know, that character did do that, a heinous crime like that, you know, it for him, it was really the cost of doing business. You know, it was that's how he rationalized these things. That's how I portrayed him. You know, it's not that he wanted to kill this person, but he had to. This was the cost of doing business. And, you know, I tried to humanize him as much as I could, you know, given the situations and who he is and what he did. But, you know, what he did, it was just par for the course. But he was a bad man. Antoine Mitchell was a bad man.
So you said that you knew people like him, and who tried to, like, mentor some of the young people in the community. So what was your relationship with one of the people who you would compare to Antoine?
You know, these were just, you know, older, you know, kids and older men in our neighborhood, you know, that we grew up, who may have been 5-10 years our senior. And, you know, you can decide to go left or decide to go right at an early age, you know, for good or bad. And, you know, the decisions and the choices are up to you. You know, my mother and father instilled in me what right and wrong was. And I know what path I didn't want to go down, because ultimately I knew it could only end me up behind bars or 6 feet under. And that's not the route that I wanted to take, because all of that would happen at a very early age. And, you know, guys like Antoine Mitchell, you know, knew who the weak, if you will, or the strong, if you will, in the neighborhood were. And they were like, okay, look, this is, you're not built for this. You know, this isn't the life for you. You know, they admired and respected me, because I've always wanted to be an actor since I was 9 years old. This was my dream. So around the neighborhood, I was the actor to them. So, you know, they did everything that they possibly could to help me pursue my dream.
Like what?
You know, donating to the theaters that I was a part of, you know, making sure that I got to rehearsals or had a way to get home late night, you know, when I was rehearsing plays and things like that. Coming out and supporting me at events. I went to the high school for the performing arts. They would come out to my performances, you know, because they wanted to be a part of something that was good and pure from where they came from. That's what I believed. So, you know, they would see that, and then they'd go back to the hood doing what they did and had a smile on their face. And they're like, man, you should have seen the actor this weekend. You should have seen them in this scene. You should have seen them in that commercial. So now when they see me on television or in films, you know, they feel a part of that, you know, regardless of where they are right now.
So you're still in touch with them, and regardless of where they are, sounds like some of them are in prison.
Oh, yeah, they are.
Uh-huh, mm-hmm.
They are.
But you're still in touch.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's where I'm from. It's who I am. I can't disconnect myself from you know, my life, from where I was born and raised and bred as a young man. It's part of my makeup. It's what makes me who I am. So I can't just cut off my left arm because, you know, I don't use it as often as I used to.
How'd you get the part in The Shield?
I went in.
I should mention you'd done a lot of comedies before. You were probably better known for comedy.
Yeah, I was, you know, I had a string of comedies. You know, the last, prior to The Shield, the first 7 years of my career have been all comedic films and sitcoms. And so I was, not really tired of being the funny guy. It was just like, you know what, before I'm typecast as, you know, the comic relief or the funny guy in this industry, you know what, let me take a step back and really show them what I can do and what I've been training at since I was 9. And I got the call from Sean Ryan to come in and audition for The Shield. I went in, I auditioned with everybody else, and I made it down to, you know, their final decision. I don't know who else was involved, but I eventually won out for the character of Antoine Mitchell.
My guest is Anthony Anderson, and he's now starring in the new Fox TV series, K-ville, which is a cop series set in New Orleans. You said that your mother was, you described her as a career extra in another interview. What role did acting play in her life?
It's because of my mother that I'm doing what I'm doing today. You know, she would do community theater, and I can distinctly remember sitting in the theater at Compton Community College, and my mother is on stage in a rehearsal of A Raisin in the Sun. And I'm sitting in the back of the house playing with my brothers and sisters, and I just happen to look to the stage at 9 years old and say, you know what? That's what I'm going to do with my life. And I went back to playing with my toys. That's when I had my epiphany. And consciously and subconsciously, since the age of 9, I've been preparing myself for not only where I am in my career right now, but where I see myself years from now. And that was the moment.
So when you were 9 and 10, what did you do to start preparing yourself for that path?
You know, anything that I can do in front of an audience, you know, be it reading poetry in school, spelling bees, you know, school plays, weekend conservatories, things like that. Any time there was an instance for me to get up and read out loud in class or whatnot, I you know, capitalized on every opportunity it was for me to do something like that, just to be in front of an audience and perform.
My guest is Anthony Anderson. He stars in the new Fox series, K-ville. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Anthony Anderson. He stars in the new Fox cop series, K-ville. Although he's become known as a dramatic actor, he got his start in comedies. His comedic films include Kangaroo Jack, Big Mama's House, and Me, Myself, and Irene. He even had a short-lived sitcom called All About the Andersons. Here's a scene from one of the film comedies he co-starred in, Malibu's Most Wanted. Anderson plays one of two actors who have just been hired by a politician to play gangsters and kidnap his son to scare him. The other actor, played by Taye Diggs, is running through his lines while Anderson directs him.
Give me a ride, punker. I will dust your ass.
Nope. Not convincing.
Damn it.
Find your core character, Sean. You are an oppressed black man from the ghetto.
Yeah, I'm having trouble finding this one, man.
Hey, think Tupac.
All right, let me try it again. Just stay with me.
I see it. Action! Give me a ride, punker. I will dust your ass. At a biatch, and I think you got it.
Give me your ride, punk, or I will dust your ass, biatch.
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 Cricket. Turn around and do it again. bitch!
That's my guest, Anthony Anderson, with Taye Diggs in a scene from Malibu's Most Wanted. Now, you had a short-lived sitcom called All About the Andersons that was loosely based on your own life. What parts of your life did you draw on for that show?
Every aspect of it. You know, I created that with my partner, Adam Glass. And it was just, you know, a show about, you know, three generations of men living under one roof, you know, my father, myself, and my son. But, you know, the character on the show was my character pre-Howard University and post-Howard University. And that's what it was, you know, just having a dream and having a father who, you know, worked with his hands in the steel mills, you know, his entire life and not really understanding, you know, the visionary of his child, of his son, you know, who had a dream. It was like, okay, yeah, it's good to have a dream, but what are you going to do with that? How does your dream pay a mortgage? How does your dream put food on the table? You know, my father was a man's man, and so he really couldn't grasp that concept of me wanting this, you know, to the point where we got into an argument when he asked me what I did, and I was like, well, I'm an actor. He grabbed the remote control and turned on the television and flipped through the channels and pointed out people who were really acting. He said, now, where are you? And I was like, wow, okay, Pops. Okay, you got me. You got me. But, you know, so that's what it was about. And, you know, before he passed on, he was able to see my career and to see my successes and enjoy that with me. And, you know, we sat and would talk about it. And he understood.
In your sitcom, All About the Andersons, your father was so tired of you freeloading in his home that he took the phone out and put a payphone in the living room that allowed you to make local calls only, but for a fee. He padlocked the refrigerator so you couldn't eat his food. Did things like that really happen to you?
No, that's true. That's true. You can ask anybody that grew up with me. My father put padlocks on the refrigerators and took all the phone jacks out of the house and put one jack in the family room and put a payphone in there that you could only dial local numbers on. So I couldn't even dial outside of the area code. If I tried to dial more than seven numbers, the phone would automatically take my money because it thought I was trying to do something illegal, mind you. And literally, I had to put a quarter in the phone every 3 minutes.
Well, let me ask you about some of the other movies that you've made. Could we do this? Can I name the movie and can you tell me something really interesting about the process of making it for you?
Sure.
Let's start with Martin Scorsese's The Departed, in which you get shot in the face at the end.
Dream come true. not to be shot in the face. No. Well, yeah, to be shot in the face in a Scorsese film, yeah.
What,
to be a part of that.
What did Scorsese tell you about this last scene when you're getting shot? Did he give you any direction about that?
No, he was like, Anthony, just get shot in the face and fall. You know, that was it.
What did you do? I mean, besides getting shot in the face and falling, like, what went through your mind in that moment?
Wow. I die after the star of the film in the Martin Scorsese movie. I have made it! A brother survived after the star gets killed in a Scorsese film. I have made my place in history.
You died happy.
I did. But, you know, it was just par for the course. It was a job we had to do, and I was excited to be there and to be able to do it with the people that I was surrounded by. So it was real exciting for me.
Okay, Hustle and Flow, a film that in which Terrence Howard played a pimp who really wants to be a rap star, and you're his old friend, and you're the recording engineer who's working with him, and you're also like the really responsible one.
Some of the most fun I've had on a set in a long time, working with friends. Terrence Howard and I have known each other for 15, 16 years now. Taraji Henson and myself, we went to Howard University together, as well as Paula Parker. And DJ Quarles, we've known each other for quite some time. John Singleton has been a friend, and I had gotten to know Craig Brewer over the last few years because Terrence and I were attached to this film from the beginning, and we couldn't get it made. And John Singleton came in and ponied up his own money and bucked the system and did it his way. And I applaud him for that. And I learned a lot from Singleton in doing that. But we knew that we were working on something that had the potential to be great. And, you know, Terrence and Taraji and Paul and I, we made a pact that, you know, while we were doing this, that, you know, we weren't going to be afraid to fall so that we could try anything and everything under the sun while the cameras were rolling. And we just wanted each and every one of us to know that we would be there to support one another. So whatever it is you want to do on the day, do it.
Did you take
Don't
any
be afraid
big chances?
To fall. We all did. Yeah. Yeah.
What was one of your chances?
Just, I actually recorded some of the songs that you hear in the movie. Literally, I became that producer. I had never stepped behind a mixing board, knew nothing about the process and whatnot. And I went in there and I learned that, you know, that's Terrence Howard, you know, spitting those lyrics on the album and in the movie. That's him. You know, my biggest challenge was actually recording music.
Well, Anthony Anderson, I really appreciate your talking with us, and I want to wish you good luck with your new series, Kayville, and, you know, with a part of your life living in New Orleans. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much. The pleasure was all mine.
Anthony Anderson stars in the Fox series, Kayville. The second episode airs tonight. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For podcasts of our show, go to our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Husbandry, Sex, Love, and Dirty Laundry, Inside the Minds of Married Men by Stephen Fried. From Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Philip Roth on his new novel, Exit Ghost, his final book featuring Nathan Zuckerman. The reclusive Zuckerman returns to New York for a medical procedure he hopes will reverse the incontinence and impotence that resulted from treating his prostate cancer. In New York, he, quote, yields to the illusion of starting again. Join us for the next Fresh Air.